the things that happened to Emily Bartlett that year. It seemed to Emily that it all began one bright spring day, a day meant for adventure. The weather was so warm, Mama had let her take off her long stockings and put on her half socks for the first time since last fall. Breezes on her knees after a winter of stockings always made Emily feel as frisky as a spring lamb. The field that Emily could see from the kitchen window had turned blue with wild forget-me-nots, and down in the pasture the trees, black silhouettes trimmed with abandoned bird nests throughout the soggy winter, were suddenly turning green. Everywhere sap was rising, and Emily felt as if it was rising in her, too. This made it difficult for her to sit still long enough to write to her cousin Muriel, who lived in Portland and had so many wonderful things. Things like fleece-lined bedroom slippers with kittens on the toes, cement sidewalks to roller skate on, and a public library full of books.
You've just heard the opening lines to Emily's Runaway Imagination. I'm John McCoy.
I'm Phil Gonzalez.
And you're listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast. And we're on to one of the books I had no idea existed until we did this podcast.
I, of course, knew it existed. I worked in a bookstore long enough that like it passed through my hand often enough, but it never caught my attention.
Right. So this is from 1961, Emily's Runaway Imagination. Now, just a show note here, those completists out there who say, wait a second, didn't Beverly Cleary write some picture books?
Yeah.
'59 and '60, and the answer is yes, she did. We are not covering them now. Maybe we'll get to those in one of our special extra episodes.
Yes, I would enjoy to talk about them at some point. They are cute.
So we'll hold off on that for now. Now we're going to Emily's Runaway Imagination. This is an interesting book in so far as it comes after a string of her teen books.
Yes.
And I have an edition here that has the original illustrations in it by Beth and Joe Crush, mm-hmm. who did all the illustrations for 15 and The Luckiest Girl and Gene and Johnny. So it kind of feels as though the publishers at least saw this as being of a piece with those other books, even though I don't think it is at all.
No, and I have the edition with the modern illustrations, and I can say that if you don't have the edition with the original illustrations, seek it out, because they make the book. They definitely make the book.
Joe and Beth Crush mm-hmm. were the probably best known to readers out there as the illustrators of The Borrowers.
Borrowers, yeah.
Right. So if you haven't seen these books, imagine The Borrowers illustrations. They're that kind of beautiful pen and ink drawing, and it's very appropriate, I think, for this kind of a throwback story. When I got this book, I was just very happy to see these illustrations in it. And then we read the book.
Well, and I had the illustrations, of course, that were recently done for the online editions, the ebooks. And imagine, picture in your mind, if you will, Henry Huggins just with high-necked dresses. And that's pretty much the same thing. There's no attempt to even make anything look less contemporary. They just slapped some high-necked dresses on the characters and just said, there we go, it's the 1920s.
So this book does take place in the 1920s, and I think anyone who knows anything about Beverly Cleary realizes right off the bat that this is a kind of a highly autobiographical book. It seems like because Cleary came from a very small farm, and she moved to Portland, but this is a description of what it's like living in a farm community in sort of backwoods Oregon in the 1920s.
And it shows, like, to me, this book reads like, here's a bunch of stories from my past or that are related, like, not that maybe directly happened to me, but I've taken a bunch of like anecdotes and things from that era, and I've sort of thrown them all onto one character and then given kind of a through line just to carry you through to the end of the book.
as you say this, it reminds me of when I was in a writing program in my 20s. I was in a fiction writing program. We had to write a new story every week, and quite frequently people would draw from their personal experiences to write fiction. You know, authors do that. But one of the problems that you can fall into very quickly, and one of the problems that my teacher pointed out in me, is when you draw from your personal experience, there's a tendency to want to be true to that personal experience, even if you are technically writing fiction.
Yeah.
And that can be very limiting, because you think to yourself, oh, this is the way it really happened. And instead of following an author's impulse to say, how can I complicate this? How can I make it more interesting? You know, what can I do to make the characters get in more trouble, which is, you know, and have conflict? You feel a loyalty to what actually happened. And I feel like in many cases with the vignettes in this book, there's a kind of a loyalty to what happened. You keep waiting for what the next thing is going to be.
Yeah. Well, let's begin with the title. The title is Emily's Runaway Imagination. And periodically throughout the book, it makes reference to the fact that Emily is known throughout town for having a runaway imagination, which as a reader, I would assume meant that like a complication would occur and she would just come up with the zaniest way to get around it, or these crazy ideas of hers keep escalating until they, you know, are driving people to distraction. Instead, what just happens is I can't tell if the title is supposed to be a little ironic, because the runaway imagination people keep referring to is simply a little kid having some ideas. And they're not particularly outrageous. They're not particularly illogical. They're just, she'll get an idea in her head and people will say, "Ugh, Emily, you and your runaway imagination." And I'm like, I wonder if it's just supposed to show that the small town mentality can be incredibly closed-minded or just incredibly insular, so that someone with just what you consider rational, reasonable ideas is viewed as someone who has just this off-the-wall imagination.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about imagination, because that seems to be a preoccupation of Cleary's through a lot of her writings. I mean, we've had in Beezus and Ramona, Beezus worrying that she didn't have enough imagination. We, of course, have the character of Ramona, who is a girl with amazing imagination that she sometimes falls into a sort of a thrall from, that she's unable to sort of escape her own imagination. I found that kind of odd when I was a kid, because I never thought of imagination as something that could get out of hand.
Right.
When I was a kid, I had a strong imagination, but I never had any difficulty sorting out what I was imagining from what was happening. And when I read stories in which that was a concern, I kind of thought, like, well, come on, doesn't everybody know the difference?
Well, and Beverly Cleary, even like Ramona, only experiences that while she's a toddler. And then as she gets older and older, that's not something that sticks around with her. Like, she's not in third grade, like, thinking she's actually an astronaut or whatever. It's like, Beverly Cleary pretty, like, just says, like, that's, you know, like, a child's imagination running away with them is something that happens to very little kids. You can be creative as you get older, but I don't know, like, it also seems to be something that she kind of foists on female characters, because Henry Huggins is constantly disparaging the imagination of girls.
Right.
In one way or another, he's always saying, like, girls get these ideas, and he's like, ugh, just like a girl.
I think it's definitely gendered. When we started reading this book, it was shortly after Netflix had launched its new adaptation of Anne of Green Gables. And there's a children's book character who is sort of the quintessential character who has an imagination that gets the better of them. And people around her are constantly like, what's going on with this kid? And why does she have this imagination that keeps, why can't she focus on what's in front of her? And it's seen as both her problem, but also her salvation as a character. But it certainly, in her case, is seen as a detriment for a girl to have that. And I would say the other character in children's fiction with a strong imagination who gets out of hand is Tom Sawyer. who is constantly wanting to create these fantastic stories of robbers and knights errant and so forth. But with Tom Sawyer, it's seen as charming, I guess, in a way. Mm-hmm. It seemed like, oh, that Tom, you know, he's so yes, I think there is a gendered aspect to this.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Anne of Green Gables, because Emily Bartlett in this book is the polar opposite of the Anne of, like, Emily Bartlett lives with her parents in a 13-room house in the town of Pitchfork. Like, she lives in a nice big house with two bathtubs. She has loving parents. She doesn't seem to have much conflict in her life. She gets an idea in her head in the beginning. Like, so in the beginning of the book, she's like, we don't have a library, and my city cousins have a library, and I want access to books like them. So she gets this big idea in her head to start a town library and tells her mama, and her mama is at first like, oh, your imagination. And I thought that, okay, this will be our conflict. Like, will this library or won't this library actually be built? But then by the next chapter, the library is well on its way to happening. And there doesn't seem to be, like, anything standing in her way in this book. Like, what's her last name in Anne of Green Gables?
Oh, I don't remember.
Anne, with an A. her imagination is, like, this almost survival technique.
Right.
Like, she hasn't had the best life. And she's sort of relying on the power of her mind to carry her through life and keep this positive attitude. But Emily, she's just a smart kid who's had it well. And there's really nothing for her to overcome in this book, except her own, like, at the very end, like, her inability to wear a costume at a party. Like, that's pretty much it.
She doesn't face a lot of obstacles in this book. If the through line of this book is she wants to bring a library to the small town, everyone seems on board with that very
they're
early
immediately
on
board. But the library is built, like, in the third chapter. It's there. Like,
but
it's,
I think it's more kind of like a procedural. It's sort of, okay, now we have to actually buy books.
Yeah.
And this town may not have the money to put aside for as many books as Emily would like. You know, this is the 20s. It's not yet the Depression.
Depression, right.
But it's a farming community where the town's fortunes rise and fall with the price of commodities.
Yeah. Which comes into play, but only at the end of the book.
I agree that there are very few actual conflicts in this book. But one of the things that's interesting to me about this book is it attempts to paint a picture of a time that has, even by the time this book has been written, is gone now 40 years. You know, it's the disappearance of a rural kind of life, but a life in which you expect it to be maybe about, oh, these town people are going to resist putting on big city airs or something like that. But no, they're pretty happy to have a library come along. And there's no particular conflict between these modes of life. There's a point where Emily's cousin Muriel comes to visit them, and she wants to come to the farm because she's just read Black Beauty, and she wants to be in a place where there are horses. Mm-hmm. And Emily, on the other hand, wants to be in a place where there are copies of Black Beauty.
Right.
And so that's an interesting kind of thing, but there's no, you keep expecting there to be some sort of an epiphany here or
right.
something like that, but there isn't. It's just,
there isn't. This is a book, I was thinking the whole time I was reading this, I was like, okay, they live in a big 13-room house. Their family, their grandfather and grandmother run the general store. They're doing okay for them. And I was like, oh, this is Nellie Olson's family. If Nellie Olson was a nice kid.
Right.
Like, they are the ones in town. Like, her mother is friends with women who dress well, who have fancy parties. Like, the women in town, this isn't a poor, poor town. Like, at least at this point, they're on the upside. Like, they buy hats, handmade hats from Emily's grandmother. They expect a certain amount of decorum, a certain amount of they put on a certain amount of airs when they do things as a women's society. When rural people show up, when the little boy shows up at the library with no shoes on to borrow books, he is of a social status, a social class that Emily's not comfortable with. Like, she's not usually around people from the really rural areas. Like, he had to walk hours to get there. And so we're seeing, it's, at first I thought it was going to be a book about, like you said, like sort of like scraping by in the 20s. But it's really people who are doing okay for themselves and just kind of one kid's misadventures. It's very Henry Huggins in the sense that it's a kind of a through line. And then just each chapter is kind of a wacky adventure.
One good example of that is early on when Emily's mother throws the party to try and get all the society ladies of town to buy in to the library idea. Mm-hmm. The story is that Emily discovers a store of rotten apples, and because she doesn't want to waste these apples, she feeds them to the pigs, not knowing...
Because her mother has told her, do not waste food. We do not waste food in this family.
And she doesn't know that these apples have fermented and the pigs all get drunk. Now, mm-hmm. you're expecting some big payoff here, but basically what happens is the pigs just kind of totter around looking tipsy, and the women's auxiliary board comes out and laughs at it, and they go back all in a good mood. And somehow that's supposed to transfer over to the fact that Emily doing this made them all more predisposed to say okay to the library. But I don't see it. I think that they were going to say yes to the library anyway.
Yeah, it was a bit of a stretch. And you could tell that this is a story that Beverly Cleary wanted to include in the book and kind of needed to shoehorn it into a situation. But yeah, like... They see that there's the one woman on the board who's like, well, I never. But then even she's eventually like, oh, this is pretty funny. And then Emily's like, I'm going to get in big trouble for this. And her dad's like, actually, you made this party more fun than it would have been. Good for you. And I'm like, all right, well, I hope the pigs are okay. Like, I guess that was what I was left with. Also, this is one of those examples where she's like, well, I saw the, you said don't waste food. And so I felt that the apples to the pigs because I didn't want to waste food. And they're like, oh, Emily, you and your runaway imagination. I'm like, no, that's a good idea. Like, she was being conscientious. You said don't waste food. And so she's like, oh, feed them to the pigs. Like, that's a good idea. And that has nothing to do with an imagination. That's just point eight. If she had been like, I'll create a conveyor belt machine to transfer all the windfallen apples from all the farms to the pigs' mouths. Like, then, okay, there's your runaway imagination. But I don't know. Like, to me, I'm just like, nope, that's just a kid with a good idea and a little too much time on her hands.
Right. Or in the next chapter, when this is when Muriel is coming to visit Emily. Emily wants to have their plow horse be more presentable, yeah, as a kind of a beautiful horse because
Muriel dreams of riding a white horse.
Right. So Emily gets this idea of bleaching her horse. She said, yeah, she calls it Cloroxing the horse. Now, this is a kind of an odd idea, and yep, this is a very you'd think this would be a story about a kid who did this on the sly, and then something happens, you know. But no, right. She asks her parents, is it okay if I Clorox my horse? And they say, yeah, sure, whatever.
And then it works. It works. It just works. She gets like there's a creepy guy in town. I can't remember his name. There's this guy who's like one of those aggressively like creepy with kids, like weird with kids characters. And he shows up and he's like, what you doing? And she's all, I'm bleaching the horse. And I'm having trouble holding up this bucket of bleach to bleach the horse's tail. And he's like, can I help? And then he does. And it works. And that's the end of the chapter. Muriel shows up. And then I'm like, oh, Muriel's going to show up. And she's going to be like, this is disgusting. This horse smells like bleach. Nope. She's like, that's beautiful. The lesson is supposed to be that, like, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And Muriel sees what she wants to see. She dreams of a beautiful horse. So to her, the plow horse is a beautiful horse. And but I'm like, all I really got from that was Emily had an idea, and it worked.
Right. The guy's name is Pete Genty.
Yes.
And when he shows up, he's just walking across their property carrying a gun because he's shooting rabbits. So he's this kind of a menacing and actually potentially dangerous guy. And
yeah,
what he does is he just says, oh, sure, I'll help you hold this bucket of bleach up to...
For 15 minutes.
Now, the one thing that this does remind me of is my mom likes to tell me that when she was a little kid, around Easter time, all the stores in town would sell chicks as Easter favors to give out, just like live chicks that had been dyed green and pink and bright yellow, and that was considered okay to do, I guess. Yeah. And I think what it shows is people had a different attitude towards animals back then.
I guess, but like, if that's your working horse, I'd be like, it's probably not a good idea to risk, I don't know, burning my horse. Like, pouring bleach on an animal, soaking an animal in bleach is dicey prospect in general. Like, this is a working, I don't know. Like, I thought the parents would put up a little more of a struggle with it. Right. Now, we have skipped a major thing, though.
Oh, yes, sure.
We have skipped a major, of the few through lines of this whole book, there is a major through line that shows up in the first chapter of the book, and it's when Emily's mother writes a letter to the state basically to say like, can we have a library in our town? And Emily's very excited with this news. She goes running to the post office. On the way to the post office, her dog decides to join her. Her dog's name is Prince. Now there's a character in the book who pops in periodically and kind of plays a huge part in the very end, more or less. And his name is Fong Kwok, and he is a man from China who has lived in town basically as long as anyone else. He's a very old man. He used to run... What did he run? He ran a candy store.
A candy store, right.
He had the candy store in town, and everyone knows Fong Kwok. Everyone loves Fong Kwok. He's amazing. But Emily's always been a little shy with him, and she runs into him, and she has her dog named Prince. John, why don't you take it from here?
So, Fong Kwok, let's make this clear. Fong Kwok is actually presented about as sympathetically as any Chinese character would be presented in a mainstream children's book of this time. But on the other hand, he is given the most ridiculous accent. And particularly, he's given the tick of switching his R's and L's.
Yes. Now, it drives the plot forward.
Right. Because he calls Prince Plince. And
Emily corrects him.
But he can't pronounce... Prince, or he doesn't hear the difference. Now, as a side note here, I took linguistics when I was in college. LR are what are called the lateral and retroflex liquids, and if you aren't taught those when you are in your like 2 or 3 years old, you lose the ability to distinguish the difference between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Israel, as an exchange student, I remember for a long time they kept trying to teach me how to pronounce the letter ayin, which is a way of constricting a vowel. I never was able to actually hear the difference, because this is a psychological thing that happens. You lose the ability to make some of these distinctions. Now, all that aside, it's considered absolutely hilarious, but I think that Beverly Cleary wants us to think that his calling her dog Prince, we're supposed to find this absolutely hilarious as readers, and certainly the town finds it absolutely hilarious.
Well, that's my question for you. Okay, so he calls the dog Plince. She says, no, Fong Kwok, it's Prince. And then he says, yes, Plince. And then all the people around laugh. And Emily's the one who's embarrassed. And I'm wondering, so I'm trying to give Beverly Cleary the credit here. To me, she's not expecting the reader to laugh at Fong Kwok. She's expecting the reader to see that Emily's the one who made the mistake by calling attention to Fong Kwok's pronunciation. Like, because Emily's the one who's like, I can't believe I just did that. I can't show my face in town again. And of course, the town then adopts the name Plints for the dog. And then for the rest of the book, the dog is only referred to, even in narration, as Plints. I guess I don't quite get the feeling that we're supposed to be laughing at Fong Kwok.
Yeah, I don't know. It's very hard on this side of the 2000s, looking right back at this, knowing what to think of this, you know, because yeah, you look at, like, say, The Aristocats, which has an absolutely horrific Chinese yes parody done by none other than Paul Winchell, the voice of Tigger.
Yep.
And you know that that's awful. But you read a book like this and you're like, I'm not sure what I think about this.
I think, I mean, again, I'm a white guy, like, making observations about the writings of a white writer in from the comfort of my own home, having never faced anything like this before. It's extremely uncomfortable to read for me. It's was extremely uncomfortable to listen to in the car with my six-year-old on audio. Not mostly because the narrator, who was doing a great job, also insisted on doing a thick accent for Fong Kwok whenever he would speak. My sticking point with Fong Kwok is that as much sympathy as Beverly Cleary seems to be trying to give him, he's never allowed to be a character. He has like four lines of dialogue in this whole book. He gets talked about a lot, but his words generally just get related to Emily. Throughout the whole book, she never has a real conversation with him. And even in the end, she doesn't have a final conversation with him. She just leaves him a note. And my discomfort comes from the fact that although Beverly Cleary does a lot by the end of the book to humanize him, by you finding out about his family, why he's there, why he eventually goes back to China, you don't hear it from his mouth. He's still never allowed to speak for himself.
In a modern context, you would expect there to be the moment where Emily has an epiphany about the difficulty of expressing your inner life in a language that's not your own, and the how, as an observer, you make assumptions about what's going on inside someone's mind, and then you realize that no, they have a much more complicated, much more rich, and a fully formed life that you will never be able to really know, and that's a kind of a tragedy. But that doesn't happen. I mean, as you mentioned at the end, we get an explanation basically from Emily's mother.
Yeah.
And there's kind of like halfway there almost, but it seems like there should be one other thing here, you know, it's like yep, one other scene, maybe somewhere in that long stretch of the book where Fong Kwok doesn't show up.
Yeah.
If there were one other thing, you know, and again, Emily's discomfort around Fong Kwok is never quite given form or shape. It's kind of given, it's just presented as though this is a truth about her.
Mm-hmm.
And this may, again, I don't know if Fong Kwok is based upon a person that Cleary knew as a youth. I suspect there's a way that she's trying to be authentically describing an experience she had as a child, but she's not willing to do the work of examining that.
I was going to say, it goes back to what you were saying about writing fiction based on your life. Like, yes, this might have been your experience, but it doesn't make it dramatically satisfying. Like, it just becomes this thing where you just seem to have a limited character. Like, I know that as a child, you might never have had a real conversation with the Fong Kwok of your town. But as readers, we need that moment. We need that character to in a movie of this, she would hear Fong Kwok's life story from Fong Kwok. Like, there would be that scene like in The Karate Kid, where Mr. Miyagi tells Daniel about his his wife who died, and you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, like this isn't just some happy-go-lucky guy who lives in the house. Like, he's a guy who's experiencing a lot of pain, who's been pushing a lot of this stuff aside. Like, there's, you find out this dramatic backstory from the character, and it rounds out the character by having all of Fong Kwok's words just telephone gamed through all the other characters. He still remains as foreign to us as he does to Emily.
Right.
I don't know. It just, it rubs me the wrong way a lot, and doesn't make the whole like Prince Plinth thing sit any better.
Yeah. Just to keep moving on here.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if I have much more to say about Fong Kwok.
Well, there's a lot more little stories that happen.
Right. The sequence with Grandpa buying a Model T.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this is the cover of the original book, and it's also a cover that Alan T. Green drew. It's kind of seen as a set piece. Grandpa buys a Model T, one of the first mass produced cars, and he's driving Emily along, and the clutch won't engage.
Yeah.
And because of this, he can't stop the car because it'll basically stall out, and then he won't be able to start it again, and then they'll be off in the middle of nowhere out in these fields, and there are no tow trucks at this time. You know, they don't know how they're going to get the car home, so he doesn't want to stop the car, but everywhere they go, there are gates in the way, so Emily has to keep jumping out of the car, running ahead, and opening the gates. Now, it's an interesting premise. Again, it seems likely to be based on an actual occurrence. It doesn't quite have a payoff, but one of the things that fascinated me as I read this through was just how much the grandfather knows and how much Emily knows about the mechanics of the car working, and they figure this out on the fly, and it speaks to a time in which people were really using material objects in a way that we don't today. You know, that Grandpa, who's never owned a car before, understands this basic fact about the way that this internal combustion engine is going to work or not work, and Emily can on the fly understand that if you slow the car down and keep circling, she'll be able to run ahead, and all these. It's kind of, I find that fascinating. It shows a kind of an ingenuity that impressed me, even if I didn't find the story itself that interesting.
Yeah, no, I like this chapter a lot. As much as it may or may not actually fit in with the rest of the story, like, or have any bearing on anything that happens, it's certainly the most cinematic of the stories, and I think it does serve that purpose. It's one of those chapters that is basically the storyteller saying, "Well, back in my day, cars were machines, and everyone had to know how they worked because they could stop working at any moment." And here's a story that'll demonstrate to you just how different things were back when I was a kid. Like, it has that feeling. Not that, and that's not like a disparaging comment. Like, I'm not saying that in like a critical way, because I think it's one of the better chapters that paints a picture of the era, because we are in the 20s, not in like the 1800s. And so it is that it is a nice like thing about the bridge between like the rural and like the new technology that's coming out. And I think it serves its purpose in that regard.
They also mention seeing planes going by overhead, mm-hmm. which, again, it does strike this moment in time of these new technologies coming in that are going to close up the spaces. And there's something a little bit poignant about this happening in Oregon, because Oregon was the destination for so many pioneers in America. It was seen as the frontier, or at least the last frontier. in the contiguous states.
Uh-huh.
But maybe I'm stretching here. Maybe that's the kind of thing that I think about.
Right.
But what amuses me about this is Emily, grandfather, the townspeople, they all take it kind of in stride. It's sort of like, oh, yeah, people are buying cars now. Mm-hmm. It's not like, oh, that darn right. guy bringing in that devil vehicle.
Well, Emily's parents are wary of it, but they're wary of Grandpa's driving ability. Not like they're wary of Emily getting in the car with Grandpa for the same reasons that my parents were wary of me getting in the truck with Grandpa. Like, because he's not a very good, like, they're afraid that we'll get stranded somewhere. And that's just kind of a universal thing. Like, it's neither here nor there. It really doesn't reflect on the technology of the time so much as old Grandpa and his newfangled machines.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised because of that sequence. It surprises me that this book was never made into a movie or like a TV movie, considering like in the late 60s and the 1970s obsession with period children's dramas, like the tendency that like Disney had and that other studios had to like make these movies set in this era about like Model T's and like old grandpa. And like, I can see this sequence being filmed and being rerun like on Sunday afternoons.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think that the real tipping point for that interest in old timey, by which I mean turn of the century, fin de siècle culture, came in the 1960s with the movie Around the World in 80 Days, which is not a movie most people remember anymore, but it was like super, super popular. And it was one of these mid-60s crazy films that had a huge cast where they would just get all these old Hollywood stars from the 40s and 50s to show up and just do like a two-line cameo. And it started an interest in that, but it also started a real interest in shows set in, or movies set in either late Victorian or Edwardian times. You know, this is around the time that, you know, Mary Poppins came out and all these things. This is a little late though. You know, this is a little late in the day for that. This is again, the 1920s. So it's not quite there.
I don't know. I think of like the Chitty Chitty Bang Bangs.
Right.
Of the world, like that kind of like pseudo historical, like kind of fascination. I don't know. It just surprised me. Of all of Beverly Cleary's like novels, it seems to me that even though it's kind of this weird outlier in a way, it kind of stands to me as like one that I could see Hollywood or, you know, like Disney TV movies like kind of latching onto. But I mean, obviously it didn't happen.
Well, sure. I mean, it also has, I think, the most picturesque setting. You know, we're out in the country in a place that's largely unpopulated. There's a lot of beautiful scenes you could do with that. Henry Huggins, you know, is basically post-war suburbia. Mm-hmm. And when you see the Ramona books got made into the 1980s PBS show, that just seemed like they kind of treated it like a sitcom.
It was a sitcom, I did want to point out that this one of the chapters in this book stood out to me as an example of something that Beverly Cleary had never done before, and as far as I know, except for like a hint of it in one of the Ramona books, never does again. She tells a ghost story.
Oh, right, yes.
There's a story, and it's actually was another chapter that stood out for me just because I was like, oh, I've never heard her use this narrative voice before, where Emily's cousin comes to stay the night, and she has this like humorously pragmatic cousin. Like she's almost like Spock-esque in her literalness. And Emily entertains her with spooky stories. And then that night there's a storm and they're convinced they see a ghost out in the farmyard. And at the end of the day, it all turns out to have been like her parents and her mother in her nightshirt and yada, yada, yada. But Beverly Cleary actually uses the language of and uses the structure of like almost a like an M.R. James ghost story with like the wind howling and the sheet and the like the white sheeted ghost and like the bizarre sense of the unknown and how your own like by tampering in the world of the ghost story, you have somehow triggered the appearance of the supernatural itself. Like the whole thing, I don't know, the whole thing felt very M.R. James to me until the explanation at the end. And I was pleasantly surprised by Beverly Cleary's like grasp of the ability to tell a spooky story.
The other thing that Emily lights upon in this chapter is Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven.
Yes. They never say The Raven, though. They never call it The Raven.
They just give lines from The Raven. And one of the things that's interesting to me about The Raven is The Raven gets taught a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, it's if people who don't know anything else by Poe probably had to read that aloud in school. The Raven is not really a scary story about the supernatural. What it is it's an existential. Mm-hmm. It's a deeply existential poem about someone contemplating that the person that they loved is dead, and does that person have any existence at all now?
Yeah,
and that's a very, in some ways, that's more terrifying than a story about ghosts and goblins. Emily talks about, oh, she likes it because it's creepy.
Yeah, and I love that because I read The Raven. We had to read The Raven when I was in elementary school, and I remember being creeped out by it. I didn't get it, but Poe's language is evocative.
Yeah.
And I think for a child to have never experienced, because Poe's language is evocative, but also mostly understandable to a child, like in the Raven, like, you know what the rapping is, you know, like he's not getting way over flowery in the beginning. At least you also forget that The Raven is like 100 stanzas long. It's a far longer poem than people remember. I think she claims that her mother has it memorized, but I'm like, I don't know if you have the whole thing memorized. I like the fact that she latches onto this poem, even if she doesn't understand it, and that it gives her the creeps and helps and makes it really hard for her to fall asleep at night.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if someone explained to her that it was actually an existential, like contemplation of mortality and like and all of that, then it would pull some of the fun away of it for her.
Well, I think everyone. Everyone who's read the poem knows that it's got that really steady beat to it, mm-hmm. that trochaic foot. So everyone, I think that if you're at an age where you like something that's got a really strong beat to it, you'll like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does rhyme. Well, should we talk about, should we barrel towards the end here?
Yeah, sure. Let's go ahead.
Because I wrote up a summary of the book, which we ended up not needing because there's not a whole lot of story to it. I mean, there's other stuff that happens. There's she bakes a custard pie and she makes the crust wrong and it floats to the top and it becomes like this new thing in town. Like, that's the whole plot. Like, people are like, it's an upside down custard pie. That's the plot. The town falls on hard times. And so they have like a hard times party where everyone has to dress up like a, I don't even know how you describe it. Like a hobo, basically, yeah. And Emily has never been invited to an adult party. She doesn't understand that, like, that's kind of a thing. So she insists on wearing fancy clothes. But she's embarrassed when she gets there because everyone else is having a good time dressed as a hobo. And then come to find out, like, her clothes don't actually fit her that well. And so her mom thought she looked ridiculous anyway and let her come dressed that way. And lesson learned, it's okay to dress like a hobo at a hobo party. That's like those two plots, and they're fine for what they are. The last bit in the book, though, is I wrote in my summary that the library is finished with the financial aid of Fong Kwok, a Chinese resident who is not going to sell Emily into white slavery, because that's the final story in this book. Nothing else really has much of like a dramatic payoff until the very end of this book. What's his face from the horse dying chapter?
Oh, right. Ginty
tells Emily, even though we know that he's like the town jerk and weirdo, he tells Emily, yeah, Fong Kwok's leaving town, and I hear your mom is going to trade you to him for a wrench. And for some reason, this is the one thing that Emily's like, I absolutely believe that's going to happen. And since nobody's telling me it's not going to happen, I'm just going to believe that my parents are selling me to this man to take back to China with him because they don't have enough girl children in China.
Yeah.
That's, you know, yeah.
right now I'm reading Huckleberry Finn for my other podcast. And in that story, people are constantly pulling incredibly cruel pranks on each other.
Yeah.
And in that story, of course, everyone is not very smart, and so they all believe each other when people pull these pranks on each other. It just seems to me like it seems like an odd time to me that this is the one thing that felt very antique to me about this book, is the idea of someone thinking it would be a hilarious thing to tell a kid that your mom is gonna sell you into, you know, to slavery in China.
But I guess because he's the character that we already know no one like looks on in a positive light. Like, I don't, it just seems weird that he would be the one that Emily would be like, I totally believe you. Like, I totally believe. And it's that situation where like, she doesn't actually come out and ask anyone if it's true. So, and then when she finally does, it's the same thing that happens in the rest of the book where someone's like, oh no, that's just a joke. And then she's like, oh, okay. And then that's it. Like, it's just, there's no, like, so what happens is she avoids, so Fong Kwok is going back to China, and this is where she finds out from her mom that Fong Kwok actually has been supporting, like, a family in China all these years, and he's a very lonely man. Like, his family's been in China for decades, and he's been in America, and now that he's, you know, of retirement age, he's going back, he's gonna live in China, they're all losing him, and everyone in the town is sad. And Emily's avoiding him because of the prince thing, and now she's avoiding him because of the, like, I don't want you to buy me with for a wrench thing. And she ends up, and then she finds out that he's giving his house to the town to be used as the library because the library needs more room. And it's this amazing gesture on his part. Emily's thrilled that the library is going to have its own building. And this is where I would say, okay, she's misunderstood this guy from day one. She's thought the worst of him when she thought he was going to buy her and take her to China. She finds out that he's leaving his house to be the building, to have the library that she wanted in the first place. Now's the time when she's finally going to go to him, have a one-on-one with him, say that she'll miss him, thank him for everything. But no, all she does is she makes him a Valentine. Not even a original Valentine. She just copies the Valentine that she made for her cousin down to the last word and then sticks it in his mailbox and runs off. And, like, that's it. And we never get any, like, that's the resolution we get between her and Fong Kwok. She never actually, like, owns up and, like, has a conversation with this man. And I have so many problems with the ending of this book.
Well, you could say this is this is a realistic ending to a book in a way. It's like it refuses to have a pat resolution. I mean, yes, I completely agree. I think it's an odd note to end on. I think that it comes down to the fact that Clary has been using the building of this library as a through line for this book.
Yeah.
And she wants there to be some sort of a capper to that. But as a through line, it has not been a very good through line. And we've seen some pretty flimsy through lines in some of Clary's works. For better or for worse, that's not Clary's strong suit. She's not big on the overarching plot.
But you know what? By this point, though, because we have read those teen books, I know that she had gotten better at this. I know that, that's why this book, that's another reason this book was disappointing to me.
Well, in each of those teen books that we read, those were all about young people at a particular time in their life discovering something
yeah.
about themselves. Discovering, I mean, 15, probably the mildest discovery, just sort of like, oh, be yourself, which is kind of like the message of any number of children's books. But in Gene and Johnny, we had a very interesting
yeah.
move from being someone who did not think of themselves as lovable to being someone in a relationship to being someone who realized that this relationship was not good for them.
Yeah. And I'm not expecting Emily to have anything that deep.
Right. Right.
But it ends on this smug note where she tiptoes away from Fong Kwok's house. She sees him open the envelope and smile. And then she's like, I did something good. Now he's going to go to China knowing that I'm thinking of him. And then she skips on down the road and she's like, just think, if I hadn't had that idea, this whole thing wouldn't happen. And the last line of the book is, yes, Emily decided, she was pretty lucky to have the kind of imagination that ran away. Like, that's it. There's your whole plot, your whole through line for this character is, man, people don't think it's great that I have this awesome imagination. And then in the end, she finally learns it's pretty cool to have this awesome imagination. And like, that's it. There's your character. And I'm not saying that she should like have had a major psychological realization or anything, but knowing that Beverly Cleary is able to paint characters in a more subtle light at this point, even for children, I just kind of expected more of her.
I am going to put the blame mostly upon the fact that this is just too much of an autobiographical piece, and for whatever reason, Cleary doesn't want to put the same kind of psychological spotlight on her surrogate herself in this book as she will on other characters.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that this is there's so many things in here that are drawn from her own life, including the fact that she and her mother brought a library to their small town.
Yeah.
So this is obviously being drawn upon a lot of her experiences. You know, it's a small portion of a young girl's life, and it's not a time, I think, when kids are making sort of those kinds of character changes. They are amassing experience. They are amassing knowledge of the world. But they aren't going through identity questions.
Yeah.
So part of that is a little bit true to life, but I agree. I think that it's also because we've been feeling that unease about Fong Kwok as a character.
Yeah.
Through the whole book, to have him kind of dealt with in the end, like, here's a guy who's done something kind of almost unbelievably altruistic, you know, like giving one's house to a town. That's, you know, whether or not he says that he can't sell it because the town has fallen on hard times. And you feel like, well, if that's the case, that's a really sad thing for him.
You're right.
that's an enormous amount of wealth
yeah.
to just be giving up for all at once. I suspect as I read this last chapter that this giving the house to the town, it feels to me like a contrivance of plot.
Yeah.
This does not feel to me like something that actually happened, because I just don't believe it for the life of me, or I don't believe that if someone actually did give it up to the town that they would be so happy about it. You know, I just know too many people who've had difficulties selling houses or finding themselves underwater or whatever. I know what that looks like.
Yeah.
I don't know what it feels like from firsthand experience, but I know what it looks like from it happening to people I know. So but it, as you say, it's the smugness at the end here.
Yeah, that's where it really sticks with me. She's like, yes, sir. Old Emily did the best thing today. And I'm like, no, the guy who gave his house away did the best thing today. You just copied your cousin's Valentine and gave it to a guy. You told him you love him. Like, this whole book, you can't even bring yourself to look this guy in the eye. And now you're like, dear Fong Kwok, as long as kittens mew, I love you. And I'm like, what are we even doing here? Like, what is even happening in this book? I don't know. I know a lot of people love this book. I know that a lot of people read it when they were a kid, and I can see, like, having a lot of good feelings for it. Again, it's Beverly Cleary. Like, it's got good writing in it. Some of the stories are funny. So it's not like, I don't think it's like a waste of time or anything.
Yeah. When you're a kid, you're really attracted to incident, you know, and yeah. This book does have incident. Although now as a mature reader, you're attracted to things like a well-shaped plot, you know, where an action has a consequence that feels right, and you feel like it wraps it up in some sort of a narrative logic that makes a point or makes sense or feels poetic. That doesn't happen. It's sort of like there's a lot of these, like, oh, here's something that happened. I think the perfect example of that is the pie episode, you know, that she puts baking powder into a pie crust, which is not something you should do, by the way. If anyone out there who's making a pie, just, you know, pie crusts are the simplest thing in the world. They're just flour, shortening, and maybe a bit of salt. Don't try and do anything funny. But she puts baking powder into this, and it causes it to rise up out of the custard. And that's it. That's the entire... And she it can't be overstated. She tries to spin 20 pages out of this.
She does. Well, boy, we get to find out the Reverend's opinion on this floating pie crust. Like, it becomes a. I guess that's one of her things. Like, no matter how she does say in the beginning, like, she lives in a small town, and if you make a mistake in this town, no matter how small or unimportant, everyone will know. Everyone will remember. And it's all anyone's going to talk about the next time they see you. And she does a good job at painting it that way. Like, this stupid pie crust thing becomes the most important thing in Emily's life for that time, because she knows that people are going to make fun of her and laugh about it and come up with names for it. And then she won't hear the end of it until the next stupid thing she does. And in that regard, the book, she paints that picture well. It doesn't make me think better of the town. And it doesn't make for a very interesting chapter. I was begging it to end by the time, or for something to come out of it. But nope, all that happens, especially when someone says, I brought a pineapple upside down cake. And I'm like, oh, she's going to say at some point that it's a upside down custard cake or pie. And that's going to be the end of it. She'll be, yep, here it comes. Oh, yep, it's a custard upside down pie. There we go. There's your end of the chapter. Just get on to the next one.
Yeah.
But
this is one of her longer books, by the way. In this edition that I'm looking at, the last numbered page is 221. So, some editing would have helped. But yeah. I think what would have really helped is a better through line and a more of a willingness to let these instances come together into that through line and support it rather than just float freely.
Yep. Like I said, it felt like an early Henry Huggins book where it was just a bunch of anecdotes and a through line. But we are at a weird point in Beverly Cleary's timeline now. We have covered, like, we've done like 12 episodes. In 12 more episodes, we will be in the 80s, like the 1980s. Like, we're about to enter a period of time where she's not writing as much, but we've got Henry in the Clubhouse coming up, which is the final just Henry Huggins book. Ribsy doesn't really count because it's a weird one. We've got Sister of the Bride, the final teenager book. And then she hits the ground running in this weird next phase with Ribsy, which is an odd book.
Yes.
And then we start getting into mice riding motorcycles.
Yeah.
We start getting into cats, stories told from cats' points of view, and then we get fully into the Ramona years.
Yes.
So we're kind of about to start entering a new phase of Beverly Cleary's, like, writing and popularity.
It's a very odd turn in a way. There's she's been writing a book a year, a book a year, a book a year. Suddenly that she slows way down, but she's going to go in some very different ways. And the Ralph S. Mouse books are very different.
Yes, they are.
And the Ramona books are, while they're ostensibly Ramona from the Henry Huggins books, they are a completely different series as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you this, having just read the Ralph S. Mouse books
yeah.
all in a row.
Yeah.
they are not only very different books in and of themselves, they are three very different books from each other that clearly reflect different eras of her writing. Like, they are not only a series in and of themselves, they are a study in Beverly Cleary's changing writing styles, because they are each written far enough apart from each other for that to stand out. Yeah, I can't wait to get to those, because they are weird.
Okay, well.
All right.
So what's our final judgments on Emily's Runaway Imagination? I'd say if you are doing a podcast on Beverly Cleary and you're committed to reading every one of her books, go ahead and read it. Otherwise, find something else.
I would say it took us so long to get this episode out because we were in no rush to talk about it.
Right. Well, right. We'll try and step up production.
No kidding.
Okay, see you next time.
Yep.
Thanks to Emily Olin Florio for doing the reading. Clickitcast is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts on theincomparable.com.